it all up now. Mm. All right. Three, two.
Governor, thank you so much for making the time today. I'm glad that you were talking about the OMB memo that came out, the federal OMB memo, and the funding freeze that sent a lot of raised a lot of alarms here in the territory and everywhere else. I think to some extent a lot of what we talk about in terms of what's happening in D.C. could just be old news by the time this publishes tomorrow. So I think I'd rather focus on, you know, our efforts in Washington. Okay. Obviously, we have a delegate to Congress, and we also have a consultant firm that we contracted to advance our agenda. So let's start there. How much have we paid Squire Pattenbogs, and what is the territory's return on investment?
I don't know how much we paid Squire Pattenbogs, but let's say we're paying $2 million a year, if that, right? We got $1 billion for COVID. I mean, you could watch the PFA meetings. You know, we have a board member that always complains about how much we pay lobbyists. Just the 10% to 2% that we had the match, that's like $2 billion. COVID, we got $1 billion. You know, our efforts in D.C. have been astronomical. We've got the match from... it's now 17% to 83. It was 41 to 59 for Medicaid. We got the reimbursement now on the earned income tax credit. I mean, these are things we are working on for years. So worth every single penny. If we were paying $20 million a year, it would still be worth it. And the good thing about our D.C. lobbyists, we have them on both sides. We have Republican and we have Democrats. So we go and talk to both parties. We don't carry our party flag to D.C. I'm about Virgin Islanders. I'm a Democrat, but, you know, the fate of the people in our territory and where we're going is way more important. So we got a lot of Republican friends, you know.
Regardless of which side of the aisle that you're working on, if Congress is not moving or doesn't have the appetite to move certain things, I'm thinking, you know, like the rum cover over extension, how do we then proceed to get some of these things off the ground?
Well, I mean, for D.C., our D.C. agenda has really shrunk. Like I said, we got a lot of things done in this administration that were pending for decades. Right now, the rum cover over is our biggest issue, and we already have challenges, I would say. Just to be real, is because, you know, let's put it this way. The Virgin Islands hasn't been represented really well in D.C. On the Republican side. So the Republicans have some axe to grind, and they're not being shy about telling me about it. So we're working through those difficult conversations and trying to get what we need to get. So it's going to be tricky, but we're pretty confident. Our relationship with Jennifer Gonzalez, the delegate has a good relationship with her too. She is a Republican. She is a Trump supporter. She's a governor of Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico needs a rum cover over as well. So if they do it for them, they got to do it for us. So we feel confident, but I'm not taking any chances because it really makes me nervous, I have to say. So I'll be in D.C. the weekend of the 21st. Or the week of the 21st of this month for the National Governors Association. We will get to see the president on that trip. And we'll try to talk with some other people, too. We are looking at some new lobbyists that are squarely in the Trump camp to try to secure the stuff that we have or that we want in D.C. The other issues, tax issues, immigration is still high on there. The delegate is helping us with that. There's going to be a firm resistance to anything that comes out of that office from the Republicans. But we're hoping that we could get over some of those things and be able to get some love from the Republican side of the aisle.
So let's talk about immigration. The last administration didn't seem to be particularly interested in anything like a visa waiver.
Right.
Labor Commissioner Malloy told the source back in March that we needed about 7,000 workers to complete the construction projects,
mm-hmm.
Freudian slip, sorry, projects that we have coming online. Where does that workforce come from?
You know, it could come from a variety of places. I know right now the Virgin Islands had asked Congress to pass a law prohibiting H-1B visas for anything except entertainment and sports. This was probably back in the 70s. And they have been, we just discovered this because we had an independent agent trying to do some mass recruiting out of South America, that there is a prohibition against the Virgin Islands. So we got to get that changed on number one. And then I think the bluster of the initial changes in the administration would dull out. Once we see the full impact of what really strong anti-immigration policy does, we're going to have to make some deals. And hopefully one of those deals would be with our South American neighbors, allowing skilled workers to come into the United States and the U.S. Virgin Islands to do work. They're already here. We got a lot of Colombians and Venezuelans in our community doing construction work. We just need more. And then the likelihood, remember, this is a 10, 15-year operation. It's not like you need 7,000 workers today. So what's going to happen is America will have a recession within the next 5 years. And when that economy dips, the power of our federal dollars will essentially inure or make us immune to fluctuations in the economy. Because you have so much money coming in all the time in construction, it would affect our tourism product, but not our construction product. So when that happens, we expect to see more workers come through as well, too.
It's a little strange to be almost counting on a national recession.
Imagine that.
Provide an influx of workers too.
Yeah, I was hoping that, you know, we got the recession scare, and I was kind of hoping that we would get a little bit of a recession so we could, because usually Virgin Islanders come home as well too when that happens. The other thing I think is going to be significant is I think we'll get the refinery restarted again, and that's going to create a lot of new workers coming to the Virgin Islands. And a lot of that labor is going to be skilled labor, but a lot of that labor is going to be general labor. So it's going to help, especially St. Croix, once they get a refinery, because they're going to have to do some turnaround on the refinery before they get it started. Those workers, when they come here, could also help and join the recovery to do the bigger projects like the hospitals and a lot of the schools that we're going to have underway.
Yes, sir. And you cited some specific figures about what that would refinery restart would do for our economy. And I think you've mentioned 400 jobs. How many of those are jobs for Virgin Islanders, and how many are these skilled workers who would be coming in for the restart?
Well, the 400 jobs, I mean, we're at a, you know, one of the things, if you look at the plan, the Vision 2020, one of the 2040, sorry, was to increase the population. We've lost 20% of our population. So whether they're Virgin Islanders jobs or they're foreign labor jobs, meaning foreign labor from the Eastern Caribbean or from the United States mainland or from Haiti or Santo Domingo, isn't really the question. We just need people. So Virgin Islanders, if you notice, everything I do now is about getting people to get prepared for this massive change. Upskill, get your education, get a new skill set, open a business, invest in a piece of property, a commercial, a land, because the tsunami of inflation that comes with it is going to be crippling. We've seen it happen before in the 70s with a massive population growth, with the advent of all the stuff that our forefathers did before, oil, alumina, watches, textiles, pharmaceuticals, is going to happen again through construction. So if we get ready, Virgin Islanders will be able to take advantage of this. But if they don't, there's going to be people coming from other places who are going to get the benefit of it. So I'm not so concerned about who those jobs are. I am concerned that we'll have people to do the work, which will add to the income tax and other taxes that'll help the government do the things it needs to do.
But this relies on the refinery restarting, and that's something that seems like it's been perpetually on the horizon, at least for the entire time I've lived in the territory.
But remember, you know, the refinery started. And in order to get the refinery started, I had to get it as act as an intermediary and call the Trump people, right, who forced the rank and file EPA people to come to some reasonable agreement. And that's how we get the refinery on. When Biden came back to office, of course, we had the upset of the refinery. I called the refinery and told them, listen, shut it down. The EPA then called them and said, oh, you have a mandatory shutdown. They never really shut the refinery down. It was already down when they made that edict. But Biden is gone and Trump is in. The only thing I could characterize the EPA director under the Biden administrator is a terrorist. I mean, he was just unreasonable in terms of what they're trying to do to us. And they told us clearly, they don't care about our economy. All they care about is their mandate by the EPA. And that is really victimization of a society.
There's the economic impact of that and that edict from the EPA, but how do you then balance the legitimate safety and environmental concerns that Virgin Islanders do have about the refinery reopening?
I think it's a reasonable balance, and that's not what we're asking for, because even in the speech I emphasize a safe restart of the refinery. But they are strategically creating hurdles that will cripple the refinery. Like the EPA was sending out memos, even when we were looking at refinancing and getting the refinery sold when it was in bankruptcy, sending out memos that would shortchange any reasonable bidder coming in, creating an atmosphere where investors wouldn't put any money in because the EPA constantly is assessing, like, you'll never get a permit. They don't say so directly, but the timing of which they do what they did. And then when you have, because remember now, we have a totally new owner for the refinery, right? They're still holding them accountable for what the last owner did. So why not? We're restarting. Let's reset this if we really want to do that. Let's put a reasonable timeline in order for the flare gas recovery system to be put in. And then, you know, a reasonable amount of support behind the refinery to start safely. Instead, what they're doing is creating timelines that there's no way they could be able to finance what they need to do and do it. Because remember, the refinery was human error. When they looked at the report of why they had to release, it was human error. It wasn't anything with the machinery or equipment. Human error. So that is a result of not having a trained workforce. Well, I should say trained enough workforce, a younger workforce than what they had before. So one of the commitments of the new owner is to make sure we bring back some of the people who've been there before, who know the refinery, so we could have a safe startup and a safe operation.
I'll ask one more question about the refinery, but I feel like there was a sort of contradiction in terms there. There was the part where the errors had to, there was a result of human error, and then you're also talking about bringing back the people who were there before who know the refinery. So
before the refinery closed in 2012.
Okay.
Not the people who were there who had the human error.
Just wanted to be clear about that.
Thank you.
That is something that I think people would raise their
eyes. Yeah, I think, you know, of everywhere I've worked, working for Leon Hess in the Hovic refinery was the best working experience I've ever had. In terms of efficiency, in terms of responsibility, and in terms of safety. That's where I came out of college and learned my work ethic. And you could eat off the ground in there. When you dismantle a work ethic like that, it's very hard to rebuild that culture again. And that's what the restart was suffering for. A lot of these guys are retired. They were up to today, I was speaking with a gentleman, and he was telling me, his question is, when are you going to get the refinery open so I could come home? Because they're working in refineries in Canada, Louisiana, Texas, all over the place. So, and a lot of people want to come home.
I'd like to move on to healthcare in the territory. I know there's been a lot of discussion about hospitals. Mm-hmm. But additionally, 17,000 Virgin Islanders more or less lost Medicaid last summer when that expansion lapsed, or not lapsed, but they were spun off Medicaid.
Yeah.
The territory still lacks a lot of mental health infrastructure. Senator Ray Fonseca, who chairs the Senate Health Committee, has been calling for a state of emergency over hospitals for a while.
I laugh. Imagine a senator calling for a state of emergency after the Senate voted to not allow the governor of the Virgin Islands to touch any of the Epstein money in a state for any reason, even in a state of emergency. I think what he's saying is there needs to be concern, alarm, but a state of emergency is a declaration that would allow me to use any existing funding to help the situation. But the reality of it is the Virgin Islands is already housing people. Up to yesterday, right where you're sitting, the Winnie Testemark, who is the director of Bureau of Corrections, was telling me we have some people who are incarcerated because they can't stand trial due to their mental illness, or they're not guilty by reason of insanity, that we could return to the territory, that they're stabilized, that they have them on medication. We do have a mental health program at the correction center, the John Bell Correction Center here in St. Croix, that we could start to replace these people. This one individual is $20,000 a month we pay. And we have several individuals like that. We have the count was 79 people that we pay $9 million for, something around it. Don't quote me on exactly, I can get you the exact number later, but somewhere in that ballpark that we spend every year. And we had a sit down about, okay, how do we repatriate these mental health patients to the territory? And they have different types of maladies, mental health illnesses, and all of them can be served in the same facility. So at this point, it's cheaper for us to keep them away. Secondly, you know, we need to grow up in the Virgin Islands and realize that we can't have everything in St. Thomas and St. Croix. We can't have two mental health facilities. We can't afford it. You know, everything is cheaper in St. Croix. It's cheaper to do it in St. Croix. But the reality is we have Idris Shelterman right now that we're trying to repair, and we're in the process of purchasing Seaview that we want to use for multi-purpose elder care, mental health, and youth rehabilitation. So we're doing things, but I mean, we still continue. We have one psychologist, you know, that Dr. Sang is doing her best to serve everybody, and getting people here and attracting them has been incredibly difficult. It's not a Virgin Islands problem, it's a national problem. So we'll continue to do what we can around mental health, but it's no easy road. And it costs us a lot of money to house people off island, but that's what we have to do.
You mentioned that a lot of what the senator was doing was about raising alarm. Is there a sense of alarm within your administration about the state of our mental health capacity and our ability to provide health care?
I think, yeah, there's always been an alarm. I think we don't do ourselves justice when we talk about the people that work in our hospitals and our health care system. You know, we went through the whole of COVID, and when hospitals in the States were overflowing and packing dead bodies and trailers, we didn't have that situation. The second thing I wanted to say, people compare the Virgin Islands Hospital with Cleveland Clinic. There's no comparison. You can't compare a rural hospital with a metropolitan, multi-state hospital. I think our hospital does really good, and no one wants to recognize that all these gunshot victims, all the immigrants that get hurt, all the babies that are born, for people who don't have health insurance, we take care of it. Like you mentioned, we took 17,000 people off of Medicare. You know what that means? Medicaid. You know what that means? They don't get preventative care. But they still get care, because if you get sick in the Virgin Islands, we got to take care of you. We got to pay. Everybody gets on Facebook, social media, and comments about how bad the mental health or how the hospital, but nobody's willing to pay a dollar more in order to secure it. So I think our healthcare system is growing in the right direction. We're trying our best to create the systems that are going to allow us to do. But healthcare has always been an issue, and I don't think there'll be a day in the Virgin Islands history where it's not, and where it's not a priority. Mental health, we'll continue to work with it. And we're working at the school level, too, trying to help kids at the school level deal with all the situations that we have. But I go to Washington, D.C., and the amount of people I see with behavioral health problems living in tents, I don't think it's any different than anywhere else in America.
Thank you. And I'd like to devote a fair amount of time to the code of conduct that you announced during the State of the Territory. Is it fair to say that that was in response or in the wake of indictments against three former members of your cabinet?
Yeah, I could say so, because if it's one thing, you could say, I never thought that I'd be dealing with corruption, or allegations of corruption, I should say, on this level. In the Turnbull administration, you know, we had a lot of people go to jail, a lot. You know, a couple of people go to jail, high officials. And in the DeYoung administration, I thought we wiped out any hint of that. But one of my colleagues pointed out to me, he said, you notice there are only corruption cases when there's a lot of money. We've been broke for years. There's a lot of money in the Virgin Islands are now going around. And you can't make up people's mind, you know, about what they want to do. That's the one thing you can legislate. So, no, I didn't think I would have to mess with it, but we had the legislation. I think we looked at the legislation that Senator Giddens had put up. But my biggest thing about that is I want people to be aware of what they're up against and what the rules are. Because when the rules aren't clear, you could arrest people very easily, especially if they don't understand what they're doing. So our education of people with our program through personnel and our code of conduct by the governor is about protecting individuals and making sure they know what their rights are and what they're supposed to be doing in order to be a government employee, and protecting the finances and assets of the government of the Virgin Islands.
So we do have laws that guard against conflicts of interest, and as you know, parts of the government, we have Whistleblowers Protection Act. The same day that you unveiled the executive order, the code of conduct, the government filed a pretty scathing response to a former HFA executive who had filed a whistleblower complaint against the agency. She'd alleged basically improper contracting, processing, things like that. So
I'm laughing because people, when they get fired, they always have so much to say. They never have nothing to say when they're working, right? So that's in litigation. I don't want to comment on that. But if you follow the trail, the RT Park, the guy Peter, now he's suing the Virgin Islands government too. It's like, you get dismissed, you find an attorney, you shake down the government so you could get some money. I mean, that's the MO, right? I mean, maybe there's something there. I mean, maybe there's fire where there's smoke. But how come you wasn't whistleblowing when you were an employee? Why didn't you request a meeting to say this is going on, or, you know?
Well, I'm not aware.
Excuse me, 1 second. Sorry about that, guys.
No worries.
You're back on.
Okay, sorry about that, Governor. So we were discussing whistleblowers and whistleblowing more generally. I'm aware of at least three such suits in the past year that speak to HFA, the RT Park, as you mentioned, and one about WAPA and its water lab. There hasn't been
all people who's been terminated. I let a record speak for itself.
Great. With the code of conduct, you've said how you feel about those specific lawsuits, but how should and why should Virgin Islanders feel confident about corruption or fraud or abuse being prevented in the government, given that we already had laws and safeguards in place to prevent them?
This is 6 years I'm in office. So we've gone through at least $6 billion worth of transactions. There's 6,000 points of failure for me, because there's 6,000 people that work for the government and probably 10,000 in all. And we have, in my tenure, from all I know, I'd say we have 20 allegations I'm talking about all government employees now, 20 allegations. It's 20 too much. But when you look at it, the amount of transactions that we do every day, it's a pretty impressive record still. I'm not saying there's no corruption, right? But massive corruption through our government? I don't think so. I mean, like I said, there's never been a time when there'd been more transparent government. I remember when the Daily News used to harass John DeYoung and his administration for the employee listing of who's making what. Now you could look at it at your fingertips. You could look at any invoice in the government, any vendor, you could see how much money they made, you know. So, and it's made it easier for us too to pinpoint things. I got some stuff that is coming down the pipe that I can't talk about that are irregular. So, I don't know. I think we live in a time now where there's enough money in the economy for people who want to do work. It does. People are always taking advantage to do some things, but
I do want to push back on a couple of those assertions as someone who's long tried to find certain contracts and things. The property and procurement department is not always up to date or I would say diligent about uploading the documentation. The transparency website is also frequently, you know, months out of date and makes it very difficult to actually use for news gathering purposes. So,
but it never used to have any before. That's my point, though. And, you know, as much scrutiny as the press gives the central government, the legislature is supposed to have a transparency website as well. We've never seen it. We've never seen the transactions go on through the legislature or the court. So government is, or port authority, waste management, or anywhere, central government, the part that I'm mainly in charge of, you could at least go and check. We transitioned from one transparency company to the other that was doing the work. They're not a transparency company, but it was a software company. I preferred the older one. We've been having a lot of problems with the new one, to your point. But you could look. I don't think they upload contracts. They upload, you can see the purchase order, but you can't see the individual contracts.
A number of them are uploaded online when the website works or when the web vendor has been paid and the website is.
Yeah, I didn't even know that. Right?
But it's.
But there's nothing to hide, though. I mean, what would you see in a contract? What would be there to hide? I mean, we try to make it so autonomous. When we're doing contracts, we try to take people out who don't have any decision-making process. It's majority people, is property and procurement. But everybody have a friend of a friend of a friend, you know what I'm saying? I may not put my hand on the scale, but I can't guarantee 6,000 people in the government that somebody's not putting their hand on the scale to dip to somebody for a contract.
Sure. And earlier you mentioned that, you know, someone in your office or an acquaintance had mentioned that these things, these issues tend to come up when the Virgin Islands has a lot of money coming
yeah.
through. Is it also safe to say that we're in a time where with our disaster recovery, we really need things to move fairly quickly? And is that another instance where...
No, I personally think, you know, we're moving exponentially fast, given the constraints of being on an island, limited resources, 4% unemployment. I mean, when you think about the collective bonding power of all the contractors in the Virgin Islands couldn't bond a hospital. None of our contractors in the Virgin Islands could put up a bond to bond the school. They had to come outside. And even the bigger contractors are having problems bonding for the jobs in the Virgin Islands. So I don't think people understand the complexity of these projects. So it can move faster. It's like having a very powerful engine on your car without wheels. You just don't have the people to do it. I asked a contractor the other day. I said, "What's stopping you from doing a 200 house development?" And he says, "Governor," he says, 5 years ago, I could put out a job for a project manager, and I would get 20 applications, 19 of them good and hireable. He says, now I get 5 applications, and I know all 5 people already, and they're not good. So the demand for labor debilitates us. Because the demand for labor is so high, the cost of construction is high. So what we used to get for just like a simple wall, it's $1 million. You know, what's a good example? These Head Start centers that we build in. You seen the one in St. John? Did you go over there to see that?
I didn't go for the
opening. You ever seen the one in Bolongo? The one that we build in? That thing is like $6 million. I mean, that's what it costs, you know? We just had a story about, you know, the school. The school is up to $264 million for a K-8 school. And just to put that in perspective, right, Good Hope School is $1.8 million to buy. And a new school is $264 million. But it's a complexity of the construction, the gym, the pool, the thickness of the walls to withstand hurricanes and earthquakes and tsunamis, because we're in all three zones, it just costs.
I understand. And I know you've spoken about it quite a bit in the interviews this week and during
I like repeating myself because people don't hear.
People don't read everything. But I do want to stay on the subject of, I guess, propriety in government, and especially in this climate or in the shadow of these indictments. Last year, the summer, late spring, early summer of 2023, I think a lot of lawmakers were pretty aghast when they learned that there was a $45 million general fund payment that they did not authorize that was used to, it was the first payment made to VTOL.
Oh.
So my question, who authorized that payment?
I did.
And did you have legal authority to do that?
I thought I did.
Based on what?
Based on the fact that we would have lost the whole deal and we wouldn't have been able to pay off VTOL.
I don't think anyone disputed the urgency of that payment.
Right.
But they just, the legality was in question. Mm. I mean,
well, we could take it to court.
Whether or not the legislator has appetite to take it to court.
Well, then, I mean, it was paid back, right? I didn't put it in my pocket. It was for the benefit of the Virgin Islands. In any time a situation exists that's going to put the benefit of the Virgin Islands or the people in jeopardy, I have that authority as governor of the Virgin Islands. So if we lost the deal, they would have cut off the propane. We wouldn't have been able to pay for oil, and we'd have been in darkness.
Certainly. And again, I don't think anyone disputed the urgency, the need to make that.
But once, I mean, that's a priority of the governor. I mean, you could read the Organic Act. I had to show the senators themselves. It's like the law gives me to act in a public, gives me the right to act in the best interest of the public if an emergency situation can be created.
But then why bring the situation to the legislator at the 11th hour and say, we really need this?
Because I like to do things the right way. There's so many things that I could do. It's like, let's go back to the whole WAPA state of emergency. You know, we didn't have to do that. 9 months before, I asked them to do things that would have allowed us to totally avoid that and save Virgin Islands taxpayers millions of dollars. But they hem and they ha, and they may take too much time. People thought that I wanted to declare a WAPA emergency so I could put my chief of staff in place. I didn't make the pick. They went through. I didn't bypass the procurement system. I didn't push anybody in WAPA to make them. Up to now, they still have vacancies I could have filled. I didn't do it. I still let the board make all the decisions. So, you know, it's ludicrous when these people make these statements. It's in the best interest of the Virgin Islands. And any time it comes down to waiting for the legislature and making the decision that's in the best interest of the Virgin Islands, I'm going to wait. The best interest of the Virgin Islands is going to win every single time. And I say that unapologetically, because you realize if they had really acted when they were supposed to do, there's so much delays and money we wouldn't have had to pay. I mean, one of the reasons why our finances is deteriorated is because they wouldn't give me, it took them almost a year to give me the line of credit. I mean, when we're in a situation that we need to move immediately. We got a full-time legislature, one of the only places in the country to have one. And it takes so long to get legislation passed. It's ridiculous.
But then why have a legislator? Why have that process?
Why say again?
Why have a legislator if the process, the entire process?
Or you could get rid of them for me. I would love that. Only kidding. There's a legislative process because, and this is the reason why I do it, kid. I'm not going to be governor all the time, right? It's just like Ray Fonseca telling me, calling a health emergency. I don't want to set up a situation we have like what we have with Trump, right? Writing an executive order to right every wrong I don't like. I respect the democratic process that we have. I don't want to do anything that I wouldn't want any other governor to do to me if I was a citizen. So I'm not, I really try hard not to set precedents that would create havoc under somebody who has less restraint and control that happened to be sitting in the seat in the future. And that's a God honest truth. A lot of things I have power to do, and I just put them to the legislature and let them talk about it and discuss. I could just call the emergency, do it. But that's not the right way to do it, you know. But they force your hand sometimes because you got to act. If imagine what kind of where we would be today if I was waiting for the legislature to make every decision I made during COVID. WAPA would have been done. We'd have been bankrupt. The Virgin Islands would have been in receivership. I mean, because they don't make decisions, it take them too long. 8 people to agree, you know? And for the lack of political courage, you know, we need people who are not so concerned with getting reelected and more concerned about doing for the people of the Virgin Islands. You know, all the things people ain't gonna like, they ain't gonna understand. But if you know you're doing it for the best, I sleep like a baby every night because you do it for the best. And doing it for the best, I said it in a speech, priorities come in conflict, right? Like a $20 million gymnasium next to the gymnasium we have, that's for the best? How could that be for the best? You know, ignoring our debts and bills that we have to pay and making sure that we build monuments onto ourselves, how could that be for the best? Anyway.
Well, sir, I think that's our time.
No. We're good. I got to catch a plane, so you awesome. We kill enough time. We got about 10 more minutes.
Wonderful. I'm sure you've seen or received some feedback since the State of the Territory. Mm. I don't know if you spend time reading Facebook comments and things like that.
No, I don't.
Quite busy. Why do you think so many people seem unhappy in the Virgin Islands?
I said it in a speech, inflation. You know, people are struggling and it's hard to get ahead. And, you know, they say doing things the same way and expecting different results is insanity. And I'm trying to give people avenues to do things differently. I don't think when people, I read comments sometimes or I listen to people on the radio sometimes, I really don't think it's about me, it's about them. Some people just want to be able to, you know, be renowned and hit itself and, you know, because they had a Facebook post and for the one, it really annoyed me and I wrote under it, I said, I really despise Facebook posts that are really broad, don't lend any specifics, and don't offer any solutions. I said, and I'm not addressed to anybody who could do anything about it. And I put my email address under it. This is the person you need to contact if you're serious about fixing something. You know how many emails I get? Zero. I got one email from a lady who read it, found out the email, who read it under the post and wrote me that her kids didn't get Christmas gifts. And I arranged for her kids to get Christmas gifts. I mean, zero. Nobody. There was 300 comments under that. Zero. And I mean, that tells you a lot about the like people is popping up. Because if you're serious, right? Ask for a meeting for a governor. Join a civic organization. Run for the Senate. Ask for a meeting at your school. Speak to your superintendent. Talk to the administrator. Contact. I answer every email I get, kid. Except maybe Mary Moorhead. I don't answer hers anymore.
Before we go, I'm going to have to make sure I have your email address because that's good to know.
Everyone, myself. Right now, I'm at 400 and I got 250 texts. If you reach out to me, you can ask people. I mean, I might email you back today. I email you back and I answer my email, which is why I get on my commissioner's hard when they don't answer their email, because if I could answer all of mine, they should be able to answer all of theirs.
Mm-hmm. There are a few handful of things that I don't believe I've heard an update on in a while, so if you can just tick some of them off. The EU blacklist, there are a lot of criticisms of it.
We're working on that. We had we actually got a firm and we got some progress on Germany. I just saw an email come across about another improvement on that we got to go follow up some stuff and I didn't know y'all followed that. I didn't think anybody followed it. But yeah, we're still working on that.
There are updates every once in a while in the news.
The administration changed. So like they having a problem now. We got new people in Treasury and stuff. But we keep pressing forward on it. We had some wins.
One of the things they noted when they added the USVI to the list, I think they delayed the addition just because of Irma and Maria and that, you know, impacted some of the reporting processes and whatnot. But they did note specifically that our EDA, they called it a harmful preferential tax regime. So why would they say that? And
I personally think it's just them beefing with the United States because they know We don't have our own tax system. It's under the IRS, and we're not an independent state. So we can't report to a country what we're doing because that is against what the State Department would allow us to do. So they're not addressing their questions to the U.S. Why don't they put the U.S. on the blacklist? And it's ridiculous because this is not the first time we were on a blacklist. You know, we've been on a blacklist as far as back as 2007, but a couple of letters and they would take us off. There's a lot of international tax chatter going on, and I think this is their way of picking on the U.S., but we are part of the U.S. taxation system.
Gotcha. And since we're talking about economic development initiatives, mm-hmm. I do want to talk a little bit about the South Shore Trade Zone.
Sure. And you can answer any questions. Yeah.
Well, any movement there, and specifically I want to talk about the initiative to become a hub that will allow us to brand products as made in the U.S. Am I characterizing
right.
that correctly?
Right.
And so what sort of negotiations have you had to have through the State Department, through the Coast Guard to...
No, we already have the right. We don't have to negotiate anything. We already have the right to set our own customs duties and rate. As you know, then on part of your EDC tax benefits, they could set your custom duties to 1% or zero if the legislature decide to move it to zero. At one point we had... So you know customs is only here as a favor to the Virgin Islands, and there's a compact that guides that. And what happened is it used to be customs alone, and we pay for it out of the customs duty we collect because our treaty says all duties, fees, and taxes collected in the Virgin Islands stay in the Virgin Islands. That's why we don't send our income tax to Washington. It stays here. So we pay them out of the duties we collect. When it joined with Homeland Security, that bill became so much that we didn't get any money at all anymore. So we have our own custom zone that have the right to set our own custom duties. Anything with 30% value add in the Virgin Islands that's created with a foreign product becomes a U.S. product.
Since you mentioned the word customs a few times, we should talk about customs and border protection.
Okay.
And the alarm that went through the community last week with the presence of ICE agents, which they are in the territory mm-hmm. periodically doing what they do. So how is your administration going to move forward in this next chapter under this next presidential administration? And
so we issued a memo yesterday mostly because of my concern for my young Virgin Islanders in the schools, that our schools are safe zone, and we advise all the principals and the teachers that, you know, we're not to let any custom agents on our campuses in any private places unless they have a warrant signed by a judge. We have problem with immigrants trafficking guns and controls and guns and drugs, but the vast majority of the immigrants that live in the Virgin Islands undocumented are good, hardworking people just trying to make a living. My other concern is we have a lot of Virgin Islanders that may present as immigrants because they don't speak fluent English, or they may just not speak English at all. They may speak another language that are legal here. And I want to make sure that we're not harassing the immigration. ICE is not harassing those people, forcing them to present documents because they're U.S. citizens. And that's kind of profiling, right? So I just want to make sure our people are protected. We also have a lot of dreamers here. We have students and adults that came here when they were small, undocumented, went through our entire high school, our entire system, graduated from high school, live in the Virgin Islands, but have no documentation. You know, I feel a responsibility to protect those people too, because they don't know any other place except the Virgin Islands. So we're not assisting with any of the immigration efforts that are presently going on. And we want to make sure that the federal government is able to do what they do according to the law and what rights are afforded to us as citizens and residents of the Virgin Islands to do our best to protect those.
So the heads of some jurisdictions, I'm thinking of town and city mayors, I believe, one was in Connecticut recently. I can think of some others in California and Oregon have sent out advanced notice to the communities when they were notified of a incoming ICE raid. Is that something that you would do?
They don't notify us of what they're doing. We don't have any federal liaison or contact with raids and what ICE is doing. We are not aware of their operations. They wouldn't tell us because, you know, we probably would. I mean, it's like, this is the Virgin Islands. It's not even about the governor. I mean, it's like, people have relationships with males and females who are not documented. They have kids with them. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, this is a very small community. So I don't think they'll be putting out what they're doing because, you know, in my experience, our undocumented community have a great communication hotline system of what's going on and where, and gets out the word pretty quickly if anything is going on. So I don't think they're going to be notifying us of any raids or anything else.
Gotcha. If you want to talk about construction costs, sorry.
Yeah.
So what time do we have now?
One more minute. You got about 2 more minutes.
Sure. I know that you've said multiple times that the prices that you're getting for construction costs when you put things out to bid are pretty astronomical. But at the same time, the PFA is being sued by a contractor whose bid came in like $90 million below the company that was awarded the contract. So I'm wondering if you could speak to what
the... Which contract?
One of these super PMO...
What should you call...
The contract went...
Nuisance lawsuit that they... I mean, they didn't even go through the bid protest process. I mean, they signed on to a bid process that they should ascribe to. I can't talk about that, but, you know... There's been no action on that by the court. That speaks a mouthful. Mm-hmm. I can't talk about that, man.
Gotcha. I think that's all for me, sir.
Awesome, kid.